Today we're talking about securing and connecting and scaling applications for the Windows Azure platform. And really what that means is that we're going to go through various different types of additional services that you can use that are part of the platform that really take your applications to the next level. As always, with these sessions, I'm going to give you the three objectives for today. Actually, it looks like, interestingly enough, they weren't updated, so we'll go ahead and skip that. But really, let's talk about securing with the access control service as one of the first things that we talk about today. And you heard me mention in the other sessions that the access control service is really one of those services that is actually quite beneficial to use throughout the entire platform, both for applications that you are deploying to Windows Azure, but also applications that you either have on-premise or mobile devices or anything like that. You can actually use it on its own. And really, as you heard me mention, its purpose is to actually make authentication and authorization simple to do. Really is that concept of outsourcing all of those mechanisms out of your application into a centralized place that handles all the authorization and authentication for you. But more importantly, it's a service that you can use that actually uses the standard-based identity providers that are available both from an enterprise directories perspective. So you heard me mention in previous sessions being able to connect to Active Directory Federation services to basically provide single sign-on for your applications in the cloud with your on-premise Active Directory. But you can also use web identity providers like Windows Live, Google, Yahoo, Facebook, and all those guys. And the beauty of it is that it's all just configuration. Granted, there's obviously a little bit of code that you have to add into your application in order to protect the specific resources that you're looking to have authenticated access to. But at the end of the day, you're not worried about having to connect into each individual provider in order to get the functionality into your application. So that's really the premise of access control. And if we go into a little bit what that actually looks like, if you have your basically, if we look at the workflow, you have your client, identity provider, access control, and the app as the main players of this particular equation. And when a client goes and wants to access a part of your application that is secured by the access control service, it makes that call to the resource. Now, your app says, okay, well, this particular resource is, in fact, something that is protected by access control. So it sends back to, or it sends the client back and redirects them to the identity providers that you've actually configured in the Windows Azure Management Portal for your access control service. So you actually go into the portal and specify which of the services or which of the identity providers you want to use for your application. And then when that call comes in, the client is then redirected to that identity provider to basically carry out the next part of the process. And what that is that the client is then going to log in to the identity provider. So let's say something like Windows Live. That Windows Live screen will come up and will prompt the user for their live ID and their password and give them the button to submit. If it's one of the other providers, basically it's the same concept there. So once the user logs in, they authenticate, and the identity provider then issues a token back saying, yep, I know who this person is. They are, in fact, authenticated. They're good to go. And that token contains the information that is required to actually verify that identity. That goes back to the access control service. The next part of that is the token comes back to the access control service, and then it validates the token, runs a whole bunch of rules that you can actually specify in terms of what happens next, and then also issues a token that's then sent back to the client to send to the application to actually then unlock that resource. Now that we've gone through that entire process, then the app says, okay, I know who you are and I know what role you are, or however it is that you set up your tokens to actually give out that information, and then it then sends that resource back to the client. Now, this looks like a somewhat complicated workflow, and the truth of the matter is that it is. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually going to take a long time to do. Right? One of the things that you have to keep in mind is that these services are actually specifically geared towards performant-based transactions. So you can pound the service as much as you want, and it will be the same highly reactive service as you would expect, regardless of the traffic that's coming to it. Now, you heard me mention in previous sessions that that's actually one of the beauties of the various different services that are part of the Windows Azure platform, and that things like that, things like access control and things like worrying about scaling of all of these various services is something that simply you don't have to worry about. You're simply using the services as part of the platform, and then all of that is taken care of for you. And so access control and the access control service is one of those services that are in fact scalable and highly available and geographically distributed so that it gives the best performance for your users as they're coming in and using your application. One of the key benefits of the access control is that it actually integrates with the Windows Identity Foundation and all the tooling that's available in Visual Studio. Now, as you know, in working with that, if you're already using that, connecting up into the access control service actually then becomes a breeze. A lot of it is actually already built in with the plumbing taken care of for you, so you're just implementing it in your application. The other interesting feature about it actually is from the fact that it all works on claims. And that's really something that you see happening with the majority of applications right now is that they're working on claims-based authentication and passing tokens around between each other as a secure way of accessing a resource between applications. And in doing that, then, of course, there are different protocols and there are different token formats that are used. The access control service is compliant with all of those. You have OAuth wrap that it uses, or WS Trust, WS Federation from a protocols perspective. From a tokens format perspective, you have SAML 1.1 or 2.0, or even Simple Web Token, whichever one works for your solution. So really, you have the ability to choose what format and what protocols you're using based on the architecture of the application that you're building. The other part about this is it actually has an OData management service that you can actually use to configure the access control service if you're not using the management portal. You can use all of the APIs to configure everything that you need for the service. It makes it very easy to use and very easy to integrate into your actual application. And really then using the service to take care of anything that you need from a security perspective for your application. You'll actually see as we continue on in today's session that some of the other services on the platform actually use access control as well in order to be able to do the authentication and authorization for requests to those services. So it's one of those services that's really built in to the platform. Other platform features are using it. And so it actually makes a great platform or a great service that's available for you to use in whatever you need for your application or for your solution. Next up, we'll talk about connecting. Now, connecting is obviously can be described as many different things. When it comes to connecting of your Windows Azure applications, really we're talking about connecting your various different instances or your different roles together in your application, and also connecting different parts of your solution, even though they may not necessarily be part of the application that's deployed into Windows Azure, how we actually get those to communicate with each other. Of course, the primary components of connecting is actually the Service Bus and Windows Azure Connect. We touched upon these in the getting started, but today we'll actually go a little bit deeper into it so that you can actually get an idea of what they are. From a service bus perspective, It's basically a service that's available for you. And again, I know it's funny that we say service and service bus, but it is in fact a service that's available for you on the platform that allows you to communicate between different parts of your solution in a secure and easy to configure. I guess, how would you describe that? Very non-requiring of special infrastructure way of getting everything to work together. And what's nice about it is it actually allows various different parts of your solution that are loosely coupled or maybe even have nothing to do with each other a way of talking to each other outside of the actual application. And the other thing about it too is that being a service-based and being a REST-based service, as with everything else in the platform, you actually have that ability to send and receive from any internet-connected device. So of course, you can imagine how you can start using the service bus to actually take care of, if we go back into those application scenarios, to take care of the communication between all of those different devices that we were talking about. When we're talking about service bus, we need to actually take into account two different aspects. The first of which is connectivity, and that's what we'll tackle first, and then how messaging comes across on the service bus so that you understand how you're going to use that in your application. From a connectivity perspective, the key point there is that it's a service that allows, from an infrastructure perspective, to facilitate a peer-to-peer connection without actually having to punch holes through your firewall or make any kind of special configuration changes in order to be able to support it. Which, of course, then it allows you to transverse NATs and all that kind of stuff. It really allows you to establish that secure connection channel between your, effectively, your solution and those that are listening to it, or vice versa, without having to compromise everything in the middle. From a key capabilities perspective, from a connectivity way of looking at things, you're really looking at the different ways that you could relay information. So you have a one-way relay where you can unicast or multicast messages onto the bus. You can use the WCF, net.tcp with direct connection option, various different ways of getting the service bus to actually work with your particular solution so that you're not forced into a specific way of having your application communicate. From an endpoint protection perspective, I just mentioned that access control is built into various different parts of the platform. This is one of those services where, in fact, the access control service allows for the service bus to do authentication and authorization for messages and channels that are being opened. From a options perspective, you have different options that you could open up from an outbound TCP, outbound HTTP, outbound HTTPS. Again, rather than forcing you to go one way or the other, you're going to be able to determine what works best for your particular architecture. And as I've highlighted with other things on the platform, the way that you connect up to the service bus and the way that you utilize the service bus is really something that you want to make sure you dive a little bit deeper, even more than what we're doing today, in order to really understand the implications of how you're going to use the service bus. Not complicated stuff, but really important for you to understand how to make it work with your particular application. From a programming model, I mean, this is again one of those key features that very much so makes the service bus as close to what you're used to working with today already. So it has a full WCF programming model. You see all the various different types of bindings that you have available there for you to use. And it does, in fact, add two special ones, which is the net one-way relay binding and the net event relay binding. And those are specific to the service bus. But it also allows, from an interoperability perspective, you have the web HTTP relay bindings to give that basic HTTP and REST-based interaction or SOAP-based interaction for you as well, right? So again, lots of different options, lots of protocols and programming models to keep in mind, but the idea is that they're all there. So if you're already using a service bus today, and you want to move that aspect into the cloud, or you're familiar with service bus concepts, then this actually doesn't dramatically change what you already know. You're just actually now binding it to the service bus service. So let's take a look at how that works. Here is a basic configuration of the service bus and the sender and receiver. So from a receiver perspective, I have that, and it's opening an outbound connection into the service bus and subscribing to a specific item of interest. It can do that by TCP, or it can do that by HTTPS, depending on how it is that you configure it. But again, you see that it's making that outbound call. What that's actually doing is then opening up a channel between the receiver and the service bus so that the service bus knows how to get information back up to that receiver. Now, on the other end, the sender creates the same. It creates an outbound connection into the service bus, again, depending on how you'd like to set it up, TCP, HTTPS, and then sends the message across into the service bus. The service bus says, okay, well, who is actually subscribed to this particular messaging? Picks that up and then routes those messages back through the channel that was originally created with the receiver, and gets that message across. So you can actually see how there isn't anything that's inbound, if you will, from the service bus into your infrastructure that would actually require you to open up those firewall rules and really need to customize the configuration of your infrastructure that you already have in place. Now, granted, that's a basic way of looking at how the service bus works, but kind of gives you an idea of what actually goes on when you communicate with the service bus. As I mentioned before, you notice that there's a whole bunch of front-end nodes that the connection goes through there, and that's really to facilitate all of that scaling and the high availability that the service itself offers you, and all of that network load balance and everything like that, as you would expect from these particular services. So it's not something that you have to go configure yourself. It's actually something that comes out of the box for you. From a messaging perspective, really you're looking at being able to send messages across in a reliable and decoupled message queues, effectively, all of which are addressable through HTTP-based REST calls. And this is sort of what that looks like here. When we're looking at this, you have the sender on the one end, you have your queue in the middle, and then you have the receiver on the right-hand side. And what that allows the receiver to do is actually receive the messages in its own pace. Basically, the sender can keep sending messages up to the queue. The receiver will get it when it needs or when it's actually connected. And that's actually one of the key features there with the queue, is that the receiver doesn't necessarily have to be connected all the time. What the queue will do is it'll batch everything up there and keep it in the queue until the receiver is able to connect and then be able to draw the messages down. So think about something like devices that are casually connected. That's actually one of the perfect solutions, in that on the sender side, you don't have to worry about making sure that the receiver is there. You'll put messages onto the queue, the receiver will pick it up when in fact it needs. It does a really great job of kind of getting the service bus to send messages of things for your other devices to do, right? So telling it to do something. Now, with this being a service, you actually have the load leveling right into it, in that you can actually look at how many things are in the queue, and then if you need to, you can scale up your receivers to be able to process more, right? The functionality is there for you. You make the decision of whether you need that in your architecture. So you can have one receiver listening, you can have multiple receivers listening, and of course, when you have multiple receivers listening, then that actually just gives you that ability to go through the queue that much faster. when we're talking about connecting through multiple receivers, that's where the load balancing comes in, and you have the various different receivers picking up the work from the queue, but you're not having to worry about the queue getting overtaxed with the amount of data that's coming in there and so on and so forth. That will automatically scale for you as it needs. Now, the nice thing, too, is that when you're looking at scaling receivers on the other end, so let's say in this particular case, you have an on-premises application, and it's giving out work to, let's say, process data. And so it could put that request up onto the queue, as many requests as it has, and then the receivers, which might actually be, let's say, worker roles up in Windows Azure Compute instances, they might go in and do the data crunching or manipulation or whatever, and then spit out a final result. So what this allows you to do is to be able to put the messages onto the queue, look at how the queue is doing in terms of what's on it, how fast things are getting on and off, and then be able to add receivers on the other end if you're seeing that the queue is increasing in size. Which, of course, then allows the receivers, effectively, they're volunteering to do the job, and the queue's always looking at whether more receivers are required or not, and then scaling that up and down. Right, so very, very flexible architecture for you in order to be able to handle those messages. From a distribution perspective, this is one of the very interesting and relatively new features of the service bus, where you can actually have topics and subscription to those particular topics. What that basically means is that a sender can put a message on there for a specific topic, and various different receivers can subscribe themselves to the messages or to the specific topic. And then when a message is put up for that topic, every single one of the receivers that have subscribed to that topic will then get the message. Instead of it going, like sender to one receiver or, like a one-way channel that way, this actually allows you to multicast to multiple different receivers that are listening for a specific message. So take the example of, let's say you're in a manufacturing business or a shipping business, and your one particular application monitors when a package is received and sends that confirmation, right? So that application could send a message onto the service bus that says, okay, listen, I've gotten the confirmation that the shipment has been received, do what you need to do. So then let's say you might have an inventory system that is listening for that message, and when it gets that message, makes the necessary updates to the inventory. Another system could be listening for that to keep audit logs of the action that's happening. Right, so the idea is with one system saying this is what I've done, or putting up that message for a specific topic, whoever and whatever needs to listen in for that specific message can then go ahead and do that and then react and process what it needs to do on the other end when it needs to do that and when it gets that message. So rather than you having to worry about all of this effectively middleware infrastructure to be able to get all of these different disparate systems or loosely coupled systems, depending on how you look at it, to communicate with each other, you can actually use the service bus to do that for you. And it'll take care of all of that routing and channels and whatnot. From a runtime API perspective, you can see you have multiple different choices in order to get at the service bus and work with the service bus. So again, as I keep mentioning with the platform, you're going to choose whatever makes sense for your particular architecture. The idea is that they are in fact there and are available for you to actually choose from, right? So you'll the best advice really is to go ahead and look at what each one gives you from a pro and a con perspective, what it does from a performance perspective for your application, and really then see how each one of the protocols maps onto the functional and non-functional requirements. And that's actually one of the important things to keep in mind there. From a non-functional requirements perspective of your application, one will more often than not come out as being the better option for what you're doing than others. Okay, so you have those there. Just make sure that you're looking into each one as you're deciding what to do with your infrastructure. So that's one option from connecting. The other option that we have is the Azure Connect service, if you will, or piece of the platform. Now, this one is slightly different than the service bus in that this one is more on a network level. And what it does is it actually allows you to connect your on-premises applications to your Windows Azure applications through effectively a secure tunnel, a VPN tunnel that it creates on a network level. And that's really the big difference here in that, in fact, there is a little bit of network configuration that you do have to do in order to get this working. So it's not like the service bus where you're just making calls out. But the difference is here in that there are specific instances where you would go ahead and use Azure Connect over the service bus because it gives you that additional layer of flexibility that you would need. For example, let's say you have your application hosted up in Windows Azure and your databases, let's say you're storing secure data or data that you're worried about from a privacy perspective, you don't want to put that up in SQL Azure. Or you're using a database server that's not SQL Server, and you want to make sure you keep that infrastructure. Windows Azure Connect allows you to then be able to effectively merge your infrastructure in Windows Azure and your on-premises infrastructure so that the two can actually communicate as if they were on the same network. Another one of those examples as well is that when you have an application that's domain joined and you need access to the corporate Active Directory domain, but you don't want to, say, use the access control service with Active Directory Federation services to establish that single sign-on. So this way you can actually domain join your Windows Azure instances into your domain and then be able to work with them from that perspective. The nice thing is, from a management perspective of all of this, very simple to do, all through the management portal as well, and a small agent that's actually installed on your systems. So looking at specifically how this all works, the Azure roles are basically the service of Azure Connect is enabled on those instances when you deploy them. So you'd actually put that into the service model of your instances. Then on the local computers, you're going to install the Windows Azure Connect agent. It's just a simple agent that sits on the computer, and what that allows you to do is it's automatically going to take care of transferring all the information back and forth between your on-premises infrastructure and that local computer and Windows Azure. It'll take care of making sure that all of the policies are going back and forth, DNS resolution, IPsec security, firewalls, and all that kind of stuff. So the agent actually takes care of all of that for you. What does that look like in terms of deployment? It actually just means, like I said, for the web and the worker roles, by adding in the fact that you need the service enabled in your instances, you would do that through the service model, and then the Connect client, or the plugin rather, is included in the deployment. The nice thing, of course, about that is that as you spin up additional instances, automatically the Azure Connect client would actually be deployed with each one of those new roles. On the VM roles side, if you're uploading a VHD, you would actually install the Windows Azure Connect client on the VHD itself and then upload the VHD once the agent is installed. On premises installation side, right? So your local computers, you actually just do that simply by installing the agent, puts a little bit tray icon for you and has a little UI where you can see what state it's in, if it's connected into your infrastructure, and you can actually force it to also refresh the network policy if you needed to do that. As I mentioned before, what the agent takes care of for you is really all of those network connectivity pieces to be able to connect your computer into Windows Azure. So that takes care of how we connect our applications. If we're doing on-premises and cloud applications, we're doing hybrid scenarios between them, or if you need multiple different solutions to be able to communicate together, then that gives you the ability to do that. So of course, the last thing then that we need to tackle as we look at our Azure solutions as a whole is how do we scale all of the various different parts of our solution? And you heard me mention in getting started where there's actually a couple of services that do that for us. You heard me mention the caching service, the content delivery network we actually talked about a little bit in the storage session as well. And then you heard me mention in application scenarios, started talking about a little bit about Traffic Manager. So we'll get into those right now a little bit deeper so that you can actually understand how they fit in the grand scheme of things. So first up is caching. And caching is one of those things that you're probably already using already. If you're using a session state within your application, or you're using page output caching and all that kind of stuff, and you're using your local infrastructure to do the caching for you, one of the things to keep in mind as you're bringing your applications into the cloud and into Windows Azure is that when you are working with multiple instances, those instances are always available to take requests for your application, and you're not necessarily guaranteed to get into the same instance every time in order to service that request. So you need to look at caching from a session state perspective. Another reason for caching is you're looking at data that you need quick access to and stuff like that. So I will actually go into that in a little bit. The caching service actually allows you to do all of that by giving you yet again a cache that's available for you as a scalable, highly available, geographically distributed. I laugh when I say that because you keep hearing me say the same thing. But again, as a service on the platform, it needs to do all of these things. So you actually get that out of the box, in this case, for caching. For those of you who are familiar with the Windows Server App Fabric caching, this is actually based on the same code base so that there's a lot of symmetry between the two. And when we look at setting all of this up, from an administration perspective, again, rather than having to worry about all the infrastructure that you need to put in place in order to have out-of-process caching and so on and so forth, here you're just going into the management portal and setting up all of this for you. Now, because it's running in specific infrastructure that's made to scale for caching of data, caching in and of itself is actually scalable to allow for low latency and high throughput for your actual application. And of course, as with everything else on the platform, it is a pay-as-you-go service. So you can actually subscribe to a specific cache size that you want, and as you need more, you configure more, and as you need less, you configure less. You end up paying, of course, at the end, only for what you need. So let's look at why caching is actually important, and really the best way to do that is by looking at it from a pyramid perspective and looking at what you actually have as the most latent, which is actually, let's build the pyramid first there. The highest latency you have from a disk perspective. Then as you go out a little bit from the actual solution, then you have lower latency on the network and then the lowest latency when you're actually working with data in memory. So if we sort of map that onto the different services that are available for you to use within Windows Azure, you actually then have storage, which is on the bottom of the pyramid there, followed by the caching, one of which, you have the distributed cache, which is the service itself, and then you can also set up a local cache to work with your application to give you that kind of flexibility and that latency that you're looking for your application. From a features perspective, the ASP.NET providers for session state and page output caching are already adapted to use the caching service. And from a low latency perspective, like I said, you can set up that local cache to help you out. And with this particular infrastructure, you're actually not even limited by the size of the objects that you can put on the cache. So, you know, with that in mind, and with the fact that it actually easily integrates into your applications with a couple of calls to put the data on there and to get the data from the cache, you know, it's really a no-brainer when you're talking about solutions that do in fact need to scale and need very quick access to data. And as I mentioned earlier, this yet again is one of those services that is secured by the access control service to make sure that, you know, specific pieces of the cache are only accessible to specific users or specific roles, or however it is that you need to set it up for your application. So from a scenarios perspective, where would you actually use the cache? Reference data is a really good scenario for caching. Rather than having to go to the database every time to get data that doesn't really change that often, you can actually bring that up from the database one time as your application starts up or as your cache recycles. Put that data into the cache, and then your application is using it from the cache rather than having to go to the database for something that's not changing. Of course, something to keep in mind there is that when your data does in fact change, you need to make sure that you have the necessary means in place to actually refresh your cache so that it has the updated data. Activity-oriented data is another really good scenario for using the cache service. So let's say something like session state is a great one, or data that you're sharing across something that's happening right then and there. Let's say you're storing a shopping cart items or something that is interacting with the user. Again, great place to put caching in place because you don't necessarily, again, you don't need to save that data into a database because you're not going to persist it for a long period of time. It's actually something specifically related to an activity, and the activity starts and stops at a given time. And so that data is really meant for that activity. So while that activity is in action, you're using the cache. And then when you're done, you could then make the decision of, do you have to write all the data to the database, or do you only have to write out to the output? In which case, at that point, that's when you go to the database and actually write the data. In the meantime, all of the interaction back and forth with your application was actually as performant as it can be because you were going back and forth with the cache. Shared data, another example. Think about this in terms of common data that you're using with multiple different sessions that's happening at the same time and multiple different systems that need to use that at a given point in time. So you're sharing data across applications. Again, you're not needing to worry about going back to the database because it's not data that needs to persist over a long period of time. So those are really common scenarios. Again, when it comes to the architecture of your particular applications, you'll make the call of where caching makes sense. Just keep in mind, of course, you want to think about areas where you need performance and areas where you need quick access to data. And that's really where caching then, as the caching service, makes the most sense to implement in your application. Now, continuing our discussion about scaling, the next one, of course, is the content delivery network that allows you to really distribute your data across the different nodes that are distributed globally as part of the Azure network. We covered this in more detail in the storage discussion, so I encourage you to go back and watch that particular session. I'm not going to focus on it too much here, but just wanted to refresh your memory just in case you forgot on how it works. Basically, you have a user that's located somewhere across the world. And this particular user wants to get access to a resource on your or within your storage account, within your solution. Right, in this particular case here, you see that the user actually wants to access pic1.jpg that's located in my storage account that I've created in blobs, or with blobs, I should say. So they make that, or when I configure it, I configure the CDN, gives me a new URL to use rather than directly accessing the resource within the blob. And, you know, so that's the address there. Then what it does is, in all of my solutions and on my websites and stuff like that, I actually then replace the URLs that are calling directly to the resource in my blobs with the one for the content delivery network. And in that way, that allows the user to be routed that way, which then allows the CDN itself to take care of all the edge locations and the management thereof. So what does that look like? When the user makes the request to that particular image using the CDN DNS name that we got, it looks at, does that image exist in the edge location? And if it doesn't, it actually goes to my blob, picks up the picture, sends that back to the edge node. It's going to make a copy of that in there and hold it in the cache for a specific time that you specify, and then send that back to the user. Right? So the first user that wants to access a resource will take a little bit longer to access because it's doing this back-end process. Now, again, I say a little bit longer, but more often than not, you don't actually notice this happening in the background. The next time that that particular resource is required, again, the user makes the request, but now that resource or that picture, CSS file, whatever, is already on that edge location, and so it takes it from that cache and gives it right back to the user. So you can now see that we've gained a lot of speed, if you will, or a lot of performance by simply not having to go back to the storage services in order to get that image, right? So by placing the images and all the different resources that you need quick access to globally close to wherever your users are, that in and of itself is increasing the performance and the scale of your application. Now, when it comes to requesting that particular resource, again, after that time has expired or after that cache has expired, the edge node will automatically go ahead and request that resource again, bring that back up to the edge location, save it again, and then send that back to the user. Now, when the user is trying to access something that no longer exists, naturally they're going to get that 404 error that it doesn't exist, right? So it takes care of all of that functionality for you. Last but not least, when it comes to scaling and when it comes to that performance that we're looking for, Traffic Manager is one of the additional services on the platform that you're going to use in order to continue scaling your application. So let's look at it from a performance perspective. In this particular example, let's say we've deployed our solution to the North Central US data center, so that's where that star is. And as you can see, the further out I go on a map, the longer it takes to get to resources. Right? So of course, why does all of that matter? At the end of the day, as you heard us talking about in the previous sessions, all of this comes down to there is an expectation these days that things are responsive. You want your applications to be as responsive as possible because at the end of the day, it drives a much better user experience. More importantly, again, when it comes to devices and stuff like that are in fact traveling around the world, you need to maintain the same experience regardless of where that user is connecting with that device. So all of these different things together is something that you as a designer and an architect of a particular application need to understand and take that into account, and that's actually where Traffic Manager comes in to help you from an infrastructure perspective. So what is Traffic Manager? What it does is it actually looks at different parts of your connection in, or the end user's connection in, into your applications. And its main purpose is really to route people in such a way that it decreases the network latency to get them to where they need to be. It allows you, from the development and from the architecture perspective, to in fact scale your applications so that they do geographically distribute themselves as close to your users as possible. And then you also have, from a failover perspective, or a business continuity perspective, traffic manager is looking at what your applications or what your hosted services are doing, and it's going to ensure that at no point in time will your traffic be directed to a instance that's not healthy, right? So your users would not see any downtime or any issues across all of your different instances, because traffic manager is actually looking at what's going on and then routing the users accordingly. And then from a maintenance perspective, let's say you do in fact have multiple instances and you need to bring one down to do some upgrades or to do some changes, what you could do with traffic manager is then tell traffic manager to transfer all the live traffic from one data center, let's say, to another, so that you can focus on working on that particular data center, and then not have to worry about, is my traffic being stalled? Are they getting error messages? Are they not hitting my application or my solution? So on and so forth. So, like I said, what it does, its primary purpose is, in fact, to be literally a traffic manager. It is sending different sending traffic to different parts of your hosted services based on actually policies that you set up in place. So you can do a performance-based, so where is the user going to get the best response? You could do a round-robin, so when the request comes in, it's going to go to the next available hosted service that, again, can take the request right away. Or if you just want to set it up for failover, in terms of you want all traffic going to a particular instance, in a particular data center, but in the event that that becomes unstable or is unhealthy, then fail over to another data center, you could do that as well. Again, all depends on the architecture of your particular application and what you're trying to achieve with the scale and with the traffic that's coming in. So as I mentioned, it's monitoring HTTP and HTTPS on any of the ports that you configure so that it actually can make the determination of where it's going to send people to, and it's all policy-based. So there's no APIs, there's no SDKs or anything like that. You're actually going to just go into the management portal and be able to configure the different situations, if you will, or they're called policies, in order to determine how you're going to manage your traffic. Then the nice thing about that is that you can enable and disable different policies depending on whatever the situation happens to be for a particular instance, right? So let's say something is happening, you need to know that you need to go ahead and change whatever policy it is. You're going to log into the management portal, disable the one policy, enable the other policy. All of your changes that you're making are effectively immediate, right? So let's say you've switched over from a performance-based policy to a failover policy, then no longer will people get routed to different instances. They'll go to the one instance, and in the event that there's a failover, we'll then go to another, right? So again, up to you to decide, but all contained within different policies that you can actually set up. So that actually was our entire tour around the platform itself, or I shouldn't say platform, more of how you use the different platform services in order to secure, connect, and scale your application. So just very quickly, what we talked about from a security perspective is that you actually have the access control service that's available for you in order to outsource your authentication and authorization needs. Or if you want to look at it from a centralization perspective, centralize all of your authorization and authentication into one service, and then also be able to tap into enterprise directories, so AD, and web directories, Windows Live, Yahoo, Facebook, and all those, to do the authentication for you. From a connecting perspective, we talked about the two different types of ways to be able to connect, or I should say securely connect, the different parts of your solutions together by either using the service bus and relaying messages back and forth, or using Azure Connect, which is the means of connecting your on-premises network to your in the cloud infrastructure, and then having that recognized as the same network effectively, for your applications to be able to communicate back and forth as if they were on the same network. From a scaling perspective, we talked about the three services that are available there. Caching, of course, is the first one to allow you to access data very quickly in a memory-based cache. The content delivery network for your resources, your pictures, your script files, and everything that is a binary object, if you will, that's very used heavily, right? So you can put that in various nodes across the world. And then Traffic Manager to actually be able to route traffic across the different data centers to match the type of non-functionals that you're looking for your particular application, both from a scale perspective and a performance perspective, but also from a failover perspective. So lots of different things to consider there. As I've always said with learning these things, it's always good to talk about it, but it's always best to see it actually happen. So if you scroll down a little bit on the page, or if you're, again, if you're going to be watching the recording, you can actually access that URL that you have there on the screen, bit.ly/AzureCampScaling. That's the page for this particular session. And then on that page, you actually have hands-on labs that you can go ahead and download and play with. You'll be able to see how the service bus works. And then you have all the information, of course, on how to post questions as you're working through the hands-on labs. If you have any questions, or if you didn't, in fact, think of questions after this particular session, you can ask those in the LinkedIn group, or, of course, using Twitter with the hashtag AzureCamp. I want to, of course, also remind you of the additional AzureCamp sessions that we've had as part of this series. The Getting Started with Windows Azure one really was that tour around the platform, talking to you about the different services that are available. That one goes into compute and a little bit of storage and a little bit of the other services. Understanding SQL Azure, we went a little bit deeper into what SQL Azure has available for you, some of the differences between SQL Azure and SQL Server, and then different configurations or considerations that you have to keep in mind as you're architecting applications for SQL Azure. In application scenarios, we actually sort of went away a little bit from the technical discussion and really was a discussion about, you know, having all these features available to you, where do you actually use them? Which was a great discussion in and of itself. We had great questions on that one. Then we did, the last session that we did was a deeper dive into the storage services, how you can use those, both from your Azure applications, but also from devices or any other internet connected device, if you will, or browser, desktop, whatever, in order to be able to access storage. All of those are available for you on demand. bit.ly/AzureCamps is the URL for that one. You can get access to all the videos.